I'm Raphael.
I'm Kirk.
And this is the housing problem. In previous episodes of this podcast, and do catch up now at thehousingproblem.com, we've spoken with some incredible guests who are at the forefront of the battle to fix the housing problem in New York City, and including some top policymakers from across the country.
A lot of our focus on the show has been on the policy, which is by design, because policy contributed to the problem, and it's also policy that creates the framework which will help solve the problem. But we've also talked a lot about how this is largely a supply issue, and at the end of the day, someone has to create the supply, and that someone is developers.
Yeah, Kirk, there's no way around the fact that developers are a critical part of the equation in New York. And if you're going to talk to a developer about the housing problem, there is no better person than our guest today. So I'm really excited to get into this conversation and kick around some of the big issues facing New York City. I'm Raphael Sestero. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Community Preservation Corporation. I've been involved in housing and affordable housing in New York City for over 30 years, including time as the Commissioner of the New York City Department of Housing Preservation and Development.
And I'm Kirk Goodrich, president of Mononoc Development, also been involved in affordable housing for over 30 years and just passionate about the subject matter.
So together we have over 60 years of experience in housing in New York City.
You know, Raphael, I was looking back at past episodes of the show and it's amazing how much ground we've covered. We've talked about public housing, homelessness, rental assistance, vouchers, labor, tax abatements, zoning, housing as a bundle of goods and services, on and on. And our guest today has had to navigate almost all of these things.
Yeah, Kirk, you know, you think about the role that developers play in our city and how they have to navigate all of those issues that you talked about. And no organization that I know in the city has been more successful at doing that than the related companies. And we're thrilled to have Jeff Blau, the Chief Executive Officer of the Related Companies, on the show today, a company that has been around for over 50 years, is the single largest owner of affordable housing in our city. And over the last 25 years, Jeff has been at the helm and overseeing developments that have been worth over $60 billion.
Jeff has an MBA from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania and is widely recognized as one of the most influential leaders in New York City. And of course, Related is a major player, not just in New York, but across the country.
So let's get right to it. Jeff, thank you for being here and welcome to The Housing Problem.
Thank you for having me, Raphael, Kirk. Good to be here and to talk about one of our most important topics is housing and affordable housing in the cities in which we operate. So thank you.
So Jeff, thanks again for being on The Housing Problem. And we're all in the same orbit, have known of each other for a long time and done business together. And we knew it was just a matter of time before we had you on the show. So we're really excited you could join us. And as we do with all our guests, we wanted you to start by talking about your personal journey into the world of real estate and affordable housing. If you could give us some insight into what that looked like for the listener.
Sure. So I guess a little background. I grew up in a family of contractors and developers. My father was a plumbing and heating contractor. He had his own business that my grandfather actually started, and was a small builder in the boroughs of New York City. And for years, I would work on the construction sites, whether it's small houses development, either for my father or others as a contractor, and really always wanted to be part of the business. But really, you know, all that was in kind of small scale development in the boroughs. And I always used to look up to Manhattan and the skyscrapers, and with a little bit of the one day, wanting to do something bigger. And I ultimately wound up going to the University of Michigan, where I met Steve Ross. At Michigan, I was a little bit of an entrepreneur, I guess. And I was buying homes and converting them to student apartments. And Steven had just contributed some money to the school. And the real estate professor there introduced me to Steven at a conference. We hit it off, and ultimately that led to a summer internship in 1989. And I guess they say the rest is a little bit of history. But so I went back to business school, as you mentioned, at Penn, and I've been at Related for 34 years now. And so that's a little bit of background. I could talk about how we got into affordable, yeah, but I mean, that's my background.
Well, I think that's a great, I think that's a great jumping off point because I think most people don't understand sort of the history of the related companies and it's Steve's origin in this business and how, you know, he and then you and your partners sort of grew related into what it is today, which everybody thinks about, but they don't realize what the origin of it was and how deep affordable housing is in the DNA of the related companies. So it'd be great for you to share that.
Absolutely. So Steve Ross started the company in 1972. He was a tax attorney by training and got into the business by doing tax syndications of what were then really Section 8 housing. And essentially they would syndicate the losses and use that money to help pay for those developments. And I think a couple of deals that he had syndicated didn't especially go the right way. And he wound up taking it back and becoming a developer out of necessity. But there's been a longstanding commitment to affordable housing here at Related. It is in our DNA. It is part of everything that we do. And I'll tell you just three main reasons, why, one, I mean, well, besides that it's in our history, but one, we've made a good business out of it. We employ a lot of people. We've built great communities, and it's been a profitable, long-term, counter-cyclical business. And so, to the positive for our company. But probably the most important thing is really, as we've grown and become a bigger and bigger developer and build these large-scale communities in the cities, we recognize that these large projects only work if the cities in which we operate are economically viable. And that there's so many problems in our cities, but one of the most pressing is affordable housing. And, whether it's affordable housing or education or safety and security, all those problems exist. But the one that we actually can do something about and make a difference is affordable housing, because we have the skill set. We've been doing it for a long time. We have thousands and thousands of units, and we've seen it make a difference. And if you can make a difference with affordable housing in those cities and those cities become more economically viable, then projects like we're going to talk about, whether it's Hudson Yards or Time Warner Center, actually begin to work. So that's, I would say, the second reason. And then the third reason is, as we're doing these larger scale projects, we are always speaking to governments, elected officials, community groups. And when we go in front of them, you can't just be in this business and say, oh, I'm a luxury condo developer. I build high-rise towers, glass towers, because you have to be part of the community, and you have to give back, and you have to do both. And when we go and talk to elected officials in cities and government and explain our history and explain how we give back to community and how we create affordable housing, it's a great balance to all the other things that we do, whether it's retail or hotels or luxury condominiums. So I think it's important. We include it into everything we do, whether it's standalone new construction, whether it's preservation of existing housing, or it's part of a large-scale project like Hudson Yards. We're here at Hudson Yards as part of everything that you see, or in many cases don't see. We created 1,100 new affordable housing units as part of Hudson Yards. And so that's just an example of how we incorporate it into everything that we do.
I think the other thing, Jeff, that a lot of people don't realize is that Related doesn't just work in Manhattan, right? You're doing developments all across the city in maybe every borough, or at least four of the five boroughs. And that's part of what the company does too, in terms of affordable housing and workforce housing and building communities, is not just, Hudson Yards or Time Warner Center or the things that people, see in the skyscrapers in Manhattan.
So that is correct. And I'll just correct it. It is all five boroughs. We've done quite a few affordable developments on Staten Island. But actually, to go beyond that, we are actually a developer throughout the United States, right? Not just New York City. So we have development offices in New York, Chicago, LA, San Francisco, Boston, DC, Austin, West Palm Beach, and London. And in each one of those offices, we have full-scale development execution offices. And I will tell you, as we opened each one of those offices and expanded, when I started, we had 80 employees. Today, we have 4,000 employees spread out through that geography. And as we opened each office, we would put a market rate developer there. And the next, or even in some cases, the first hire was to add an affordable housing developer as part of the team. So we opened recently Austin, Texas, and we have 3 or 4 market rate developments and 3 or 4 affordable housing developments alongside it. And you mentioned early, I mean, not only are we a developer of affordable housing, but we are preservationists of affordable housing. And we today own, not just in New York, but one of the largest affordable housing portfolios in the United States. Yep. And, you know, I will tell you a couple things as a policy. We have never converted an affordable unit to a market rate unit in our company's history, and we have pledged never to do that. And while many people have made a business out of converting affordable units to market rate units, because actually on a piece of paper, it's a pretty good business. You could generate decent returns doing that. But as a policy matter, it is the absolute worst thing that we can do with our affordable housing stock, because affordable housing, no matter how you cut it, requires subsidies from one form or another, whether it's cash or zoning incentives or tax abatements or whatever it is. And it is much, much more expensive to government to build new affordable housing than to preserve existing affordable housing. So, you know, sometimes, yep. I mean, not sometimes, all the time, you know, we take the approach that you have to do the right thing about this. And so if we leave money on the table by not converting, but we, you know, commit to another 20 years of affordable housing, we think that's a huge win.
So Jeff, just jumping off on what you just said, how much more expensive it is to create new affordable housing than to preserve existing affordable housing. Raphael and I have often talked about the cruel math of creating affordable housing. And we're in an environment now in New York and in much of the United States where there are tremendous headwinds. Some of those are political and policy. Some of those are operating expense spikes around insurance, construction costs, et cetera. And so I wanted you to talk a little bit about the challenges around a few of these things, starting with the tax abatement known as 421A, which concluded in June of last year. That particular abatement expired, and currently there is no as-of-right tax abatement to do housing across the city, and the prospects for renewal of that are currently unclear. Could you talk a little bit about that and anything else you think is germane on this topic?
Right. So just to give a little history here, 421A is a tax abatement program that is an incentive tool to encourage developers to build new mixed income housing. So these are not 100% affordable housing. These are typically 80-20s. They've morphed a little bit, maybe 75-25, or in some cases, 70-30s. And essentially what 421A does is it caps the increase in tax above the current tax on a piece of property. And that increases, the increases are capped over 15 or 20, or it depends what the program is, but it's called roughly a 20-year period of time. And so the city actually doesn't lose any tax revenue from the existing tax base. What they don't get is the incremental revenue from the new construction for a period of time. That 421A tool has been the most productive abatement tool we've had in this city to encourage new housing construction. And also, let me just say, it's not just affordable housing that's important. We have a housing crisis in New York City. Not just an affordable housing crisis, and I'll use the word affordable a little more broad in this context, because market rate housing has also gotten too expensive. And so workforce housing is a critical problem, because companies that want to keep their employees here need, it's not just the, what the definition of affordable housing might be, you know, it depends on your income or family size, but let's say 70,000, 60,000, but the person that makes $125,000 and works for Citicorp or JP Morgan and can't afford to live in New York City, that's a problem too. And so if we don't add supply of market rate housing, This is just simple math, supply and demand, right? If you don't add supply and demand increases, then prices are going to go up. And so what's terrific about 421A, you add affordable housing. It's effectively cross-subsidized by the market rate housing, but you're also adding market supply. So to give you an example, as I said, I've been here since 1989, 34 years. In 34 years, that entire time, we've had 421A program in existence, and we have built every year new starts of 421A incentivized 80-20 developments. This, since the expiration of 421A, which is a couple of years now, the new construction starts for residential in New York City are down 85%. 85%. And everybody was saying, oh, the developers, they don't need 421A. It's a grab. It's too much incentive. And they're going to build anyway. So I don't know what more data the public, the elected officials, or some of the elected officials need to see that one piece of information down 85%. In the 34 years I've been here, this is the first year we have no new housing starts in New York City. And I think that's very unfortunate, and it's ultimately going to lead to a huge problem for New York City. So what are we doing about it? So there is a group of people in the industry that are trying to put together a new 421A program, which would create that incentive again for housing, which would be coordinated with labor, because labor is a big part of this. Right? Union labor has built for us and for many other developers over the years many of these mixed income developments. And so we believe that a deal with labor and the government is going to be necessary to get 421A to pass. The big kind of elephant in the room, you might say, is something called Good Cause. So Good Cause is a package of tenant protections that some of the elected officials have been insisting upon in exchange for the 421A abatement. And I'll just give you my own personal opinion. This may not be industry opinion on Good Cause, but what Good Cause essentially does, unfortunately, it's really just another name for rent control, because it essentially provides caps on rental increases and the right to renew for every single tenant in there. And while that sounds like motherhood and apple pie, we'd love to protect every tenant and make sure that no one has to pay more rent than they're currently paying, it's also not in tune with reality as it relates to the investment community. And so if we pass a version of Good Cause that is too tenant-friendly and investor-unfriendly, then we will not attract capital to New York City. And so while we think we will be providing tenant protection with something called Good Cause, the problem is if we don't attract investment capital into New York City, we won't have addition to supply, and rents ultimately will continue to increase. So I do think there needs to be a balance. There are other cities that have passed a different version of something called similar to what we're calling Good Cause. And I think if the advocate community and elected officials and industry were to get in a room and discuss the benefits or burdens of Good Cause and see how it has worked in other cities, we can craft a version of Good Cause that will still allow capital to earn a return and be attracted to invest in New York City, and at the same time, provide tenant protection that is necessary for our residents. So I think if we're able to do that and put a package of that new version of Good Cause, a new version of labor, and a new version of 421A together, then I think we could start to get elected officials, the legislature, the governor together, and think about kind of a future version of 421A and let all of us get back to what we like to do is build new housing in New York City.
You know, Jeff, that was great and really enormously helpful, I think, for the listener to sort of understand the different pieces of it. The rhetoric that's out there on these different topics doesn't do the topic justice. And it's obviously, it's a really complicated set of equations. I think there's two things I'd like you to just talk a little bit more about. One is people hear about tax abatements. But yet I don't think they necessarily totally understand why it's so important, why it actually makes a project work or not work. And so if you could, one, maybe talk a little bit about just a little bit more specifically, like why, if you're looking at a development, why is the tax abatement so important to being able to make that project work from your perspective? And then two, the other thing that I think people miss a little bit is that part of the reason why tenant protections is such an issue is because the rental housing market is so constrained. And so talk a little bit about how it maybe in other cities where you guys are working, where supply has actually led to a less constrained rental market, and how that actually helps affordability and helps stability in the rental markets.
Right. So 421A or tax abatement is only one tool. If you really just step back and think about it, when you require or incentivize developers to build 20% or even 30% affordable housing, there needs to be something that a developer loses money on an affordable housing unit, given the cost of construction. And so there has to be something to offset the loss. It could be a direct subsidy from government, or it could be this tax abatement, which just reduces the operating expenses. Either one of those, it's simply a math equation. It doesn't really matter how you do it. What's good about the tax abatement program is it doesn't require any out-of-pocket cash by the government. And it also doesn't reduce the taxes from what the government is currently receiving. So you're only abating what would otherwise be a new increase in taxes, a new income stream to the government. So it's not as if they're giving up anything in a way, because if they don't have this program, then they're also not going to have an increase in those real estate taxes from this being built. And so at least here at the end of the 20-year period, then the city will have full taxes on these buildings. So we think it is the most effective way, given the budget constraints on government, to subsidize, incentivize, whatever word you want to use, the new construction of affordable and market rate housing. And like you said, supply of market rate housing is also a critical issue. You talk about other places, you know, I mentioned this is the first time we don't have any new starts in New York City. We are actually starting new residential buildings just across the river here in Jersey City. And so why is that? I mean, the taxes in general are just much lower across the board. I mean, I guess that's the other thing you could say about New York City. Our tax base across the board is very, very high compared to other cities, because we have big deficits and big budgets and we spend a lot of money, some might say efficiently or inefficiently. So we are offsetting what are already a very high tax base compared to other cities. So in Jersey City, I mean, just look over the past 20 plus years, the waterfront development on the Jersey side of the river, it's been incredible. Taxes are lower. Affordable housing is actually not required. I'm not saying that that's a positive, because I actually think we should be building affordable housing. And we have separately built 100% affordable housing on the Jersey waterfront. But as it relates to the market rate development, it is not a requirement within those buildings. And so with a lower tax base to start, a zero affordable housing requirement in those high-rise market rate buildings, you're able to make those developments work. And you might have a slightly more kind of builder-friendly environment in terms of approvals and zoning and building permits and things like that, are really very supportive and encouraging of developers to build. And I think some of those things, if we were able to change in New York City, would really help kind of expand affordable housing and market rate housing production here in New York.
So Jeff, one of the themes we've had in early in the podcast recording till now has been the concept that housing is a bundle of goods and services. It's not literally just the apartment you rent or the home you live in. It's the amenities in the community you live in, whether that be a coffee shop, a supermarket, recreation space, a dog park, etc. And in the market rate world, people shop for a home or look for a luxury building. That concept is just commonplace and integrated unfortunately, with respect to affordable housing, a lot of the agencies that finance housing have traditionally been content to just have a situation where you produce a unit in a building in a neighborhood where there's no place to shop, no place to go to the hospital, no where schools are not great, et cetera. One of the things that is differentiated related over time is the fact that you don't distinguish between that bundle of goods for people who earn a lot and for your affordable housing product. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about examples where, you know, where you are executing or have executed this concept of housing as a bundle of goods and services in your projects.
Right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about two very large scale, affordable, some case deep affordable, and in the other case, workforce housing developments that we are just starting here in New York City. The first of which is a NYCHA redevelopment that we're doing here in West Chelsea. And so we related alongside our partner, Jamar Adams of Essence Development, competed in an RFP to renovate 2,000 NYCHA house units just off of 10th Avenue here in New York City. And as part of that RFP, we were given a scope of work to that we would have to repair, but we weren't really allowed on property until we were the winning bidder. And once we were successful in winning the RFP, we got to go on site and do our own deep analysis and investigation in the property. And what we found quickly is that the scope of work that ultimately would be required there was much greater than originally anticipated by the RFP. And we started to realize that it was going to be so expensive to fix these buildings that it was really equal to the cost of building new construction. Now, building new construction in NYCHA has always been a controversial topic. And so what we did, and Jamar Adams has really led this, is we worked with the Chelsea Elliott Houses Tenant Associate, Resident Association, and worked with them and showed them what we're talking about in terms of new construction. We actually brought them to some other workforce housing developments that we've done. And then we held, or NYCHA held, a resident association vote. And the resident association voted an overwhelming majority that they would prefer to have new construction replacement housing instead of renovating these old buildings where the buildings would still be old even after the renovation. And the plan is a build first plan. So nobody is displaced here. So what that means is we start by building one new building on a piece of open space. And only when that building is up, then people will move out of their existing apartments across the street or down the block to the new building. They get to see their unit before they move in. And they have the same tenant protection rights they had prior to the move, after the move. And so we're just about to start construction on our first buildings there. And ultimately, we're also going to get that property rezoned, and we will build 2,000 units of replacement housing, but add an additional 3,000 units of 70-30 housing, hopefully utilizing a 421A program that'll be in place at the time. And that would add another 1,000 units of affordable housing. So you'd have a total of 3,000 affordable units, another 2,000 market rate units. And then to answer your specific question, this would be building an entire neighborhood. It's actually 17 buildings. Each one of these buildings will have retail at the base, food and beverage, whether it's coffee shops or restaurants. Social services will be provided throughout the entire community. Neighborhood centers, community centers, outdoor space, basketball courts, pickleball courts, if that's still the popular thing. And so all that was really, you know, and just pure open green space. And all that is really critical for, as you said, building community, building a neighborhood, and having these new buildings that are built to modern standards with the latest requirements of sustainability. These will be all electric buildings. So we're doing good for the environment at the same time. So we are super excited about Chelsea Elliott Houses. And not only is this particular development an incredible development for Chelsea Elliott residents related in Essence, but it's also a model for fixing that the problems in the entire NYCHA system, because ultimately this is being capitalized and paid for by federal, it's called RAD certificates, which are essentially equivalent to the old Section 8 certificates, but specific for NYCHA. And so without costing the state and city any money, we're able to redo all these developments, add new housing, add new affordable housing and market rate housing. And so we think that's a model for the future. In a very different type of development, we're building out at Willits Point, right across from City Field. We're about to start construction of 2,500 units of workforce housing around a new MLS soccer stadium that will anchor this neighborhood, along with, as you mentioned, a hotel and retail and food and beverage and coffee shops, and really creating a neighborhood, because that is a very isolated area today. And so in order to get that to work, senior housing and a new school as part of this development. So we'll have workforce housing at different income bands and all the services and amenities that will be required around that. Different than the NYCHA program, though, these 2,500 units are being built effectively with a combination of federal tax credits, a artificial tax abatement, meaning one that's bespoke for this project, doesn't follow 421A rules, and very large subsidies coming from New York City. And while it is terrific that the city is allocating that money for these units and critically important for this community and this neighborhood, unfortunately, the city doesn't have endless amounts of money. And so projects like this are, you know, one-offs. They cannot be as programmatic as, say, the NYCHA program, where we can rely on federal dollars. And so, you know, the city and the state does as much of these one-off kind of large-scale new affordable or workforce housing developments as possible. But when you have to rely on strict cash subsidies to create these developments, it is a scarce and limited resource based on kind of the budget conditions that we have here in the city.
That's right. So let's shift gears a little bit, you know, Jeff, because all these, you know, the projects that you're doing, you're talking about projects that you're starting construction on in a very interesting economic climate with rising costs, rising interest rates, you know, cities and communities that are in various stages of returning back to normal in a post-COVID world. You know, we have the whole office dynamic and office conversion dynamic that's going on in New York City and in other places as offices are underutilized. I think the listener would really appreciate hearing a little bit from you, given all of the different markets that you work in, your sense of sort of the overall economic climate and how we're doing here in New York as it compares to other places where Related is investing and developing.
So as I mentioned earlier, I mean, we're active in most of the major urban markets in the United States. And traditionally, our business has really been in the true trophy tier one markets, New York obviously being the largest. You know, what we have seen really in the last 5 years or so is significant growth in what we maybe used to call second tier markets, and whether it's Austin or West Palm Beach, or we're not particularly active, but Denver, Charlotte, Raleigh, right. All these cities are growing much, much faster than the traditional New York, LA, San Francisco, trophy tier one markets. And so we have expanded into those secondary cities. But I would say overall, and people ask me this question all the time, you know, they say, well, how's the commercial real estate market? Because, you know, they read the paper and right. They think everything's terrible. But the truth of the matter is the commercial real estate defines much more than what people are thinking about as old office buildings, right? So commercial real estate includes obviously apartments, hotels, retail, industrial, data centers, and office buildings. And most of those asset types in almost every city, maybe San Francisco is a bit of an exception, in almost every city, those asset types, I'll come back to office, are doing actually exceptionally well at the fundamental level. So when I say at the fundamental level, top line rent growth, bottom line net operating income,
yep,
positive, you know, over the past couple of years. So what's the problem that everybody's reading about? There's really two problems today in the real estate world. And that is older office buildings, right? Older office buildings have a fundamental supply-demand mismatch. There's too much supply and not enough demand.
Right.
And people just don't want to be occupying those Class B buildings. And I specifically say Class B because there is extraordinary demand for new Class A product. So much so that we actually think that this is a moment in time where you could build new Class A office and earn extraordinary returns. And so across the country, we have a couple of different sites where we might do exactly that. And, you know, we had to think about, well, how do we talk to our investors and ask them, do you want to invest in new Class A buildings when they read so much negative about office? Right. And so we actually published a white paper just a little while ago that studies this Class A building market, this brand new building market, city by city, and really provides three pieces of data, which I think are very compelling. One is, what is the rent level in each of these buildings in each of the cities? And there's only a very small handful in each market. What's the vacancy or occupancy in those buildings in each of those cities? All very positive compared to the Class B market. But the most compelling piece of data that I found was, what is the percentage of people that are actually showing up to work every day in these new buildings, right, compared to the balance of the market? So for example, here at Hudson Yards across the entire campus, every day we have over 80% of the employees of our tenants in their office, wow, showing up for work, right? And so if you compare that to the balance of New York City, which is somewhere between 55 and 60%, that is a huge difference. Yeah. And if you talk to CEOs of corporations and you ask them, would they rather have their employees in the office, or would they rather have everybody working remote? I would say 10 out of 10 will say they'd rather have them in the office. 10 out of 10 won't mandate that because they think they'll you know, frustrate their employees, or they'll lose employees, or whatever it is. But if they could provide office space as a sweetener, as an incentive for people to come back, and people come back willingly as opposed to being mandated to come back, then office space becomes much more than just space. It becomes a talent attraction and retention tool. Yep. And if office space becomes a talent attraction and retention tool, the rent becomes a much less meaningful part of the equation.
Yep.
And that's really been kind of the secret of the success for Hudson Yards. We are essentially 100% leased for all space that we have. And as I said, very occupied almost every day of the week. Friday has still somewhat become a national holiday, but besides Fridays, we're doing pretty well over here.
So Jeff, you know, you mentioned the Class B office space, and there's obviously a lot of talk in New York around conversion of those Class B office spaces to residential. Our offices used to be on 28th between Park and Madison, and we were there well before that was sort of a booming mixed residential office, you know, neighborhood. Those older office buildings in that part of Manhattan sort of converted naturally to luxury housing. They're not anything more than that there. What's your take on this office conversion thing? And do you see opportunities to do that? And what do you think it would take to get us there?
So, personally, I'm not a big fan of these conversions.
Yeah.
I'm not opposed to them. I don't think it's good or bad public policy. I think that they economically don't really make a lot of sense. And what do I mean by that? So these buildings, I mean, first of all, they're very, very difficult to fully vacate. Almost never happens that, you know, it's always the last tenant that frustrates the process. But even if you could vacate them, the buildings weren't designed for residential. They're usually highly inefficient floor plates. There's fenestration issues, glass, all the systems need to be replaced, you know, MEP elevators, everything has to be new. And ultimately, if you start doing the math on it, you have to buy those buildings so cheap that they are essentially at land value. And so my view is if these buildings, if you could buy these buildings at land value, then the right thing to do is tear them down and build brand new construction, properly designed residential buildings, probably in conjunction with a 421A abatement right. program, and get affordable housing as part of that at the same time. So I just don't, I don't think it makes a lot of sense. And I'm talking across the board, not any one site specific.
Right, of course. Right, right.
There'll always be an exception of a beautiful historic building right. that you want to preserve that could be terrific. But across the board, I think we're better off tearing these buildings down. They're past their useful life, and building new replacement housing. And so when people are talking about incentives with the city or the state on conversions, I have been very clear to say, look, whatever incentive package the city or the state wants to give to the converter for an old office building, that's fine. I mean, I don't have any problem with that. But you should be able to use that same incentive on the site where an old office building existed. You tore it down and that's you built great. New.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Right. And so, you know, I think that that's a win-win for everybody. Also creates more jobs, more new construction, more affordable housing. So that's kind of my view.
That makes sense.
It does make sense. So Jeff, we're rounding third base. Hopefully we won't have to slide home. I want you to take out your crystal ball for 2024 as we wrap this up. We know the governor's housing compact had some challenges. We didn't get 421A last year. As you mentioned, the tension between good cause and 421A at the city level, the asylum seeker crisis has been a tremendous challenge for the mayor and the administration, housing tens of thousands of newcomers to the city, a spike in the budget for the city, and what that's meant for belt tightening in the current and next fiscal year. And that doesn't seem to be abating. So from your perspective, looking ahead to 2024 and beyond with respect to legislative opportunities and policy fixes, what do you think is realistic at the city and state level going forward? And what do you think will happen?
So maybe I'll just zoom out a little bit before that. The other thing, you know, I didn't particularly mention when you asked me macro about the national economy. Obviously, our capital markets are very disrupted today. And, you know, capital markets are the lifeblood of everything that we do in housing or any type of development. And as interest rates continue to stay high, that has frustrated the new development process across all asset types. And it becomes more and more difficult to get any type of housing to work, even with incentives, with subsidies, because our cost of capital is so high. So, you know, when you ask about 24, you know, we are all hopeful that the Fed starts to ease next year and we start to see a little bit of a drop in interest rates, but more importantly, that would lead to stabilization. And because it's not just the increased interest rates and debt service, but it's also the willingness or the desire of the banks to lend in this environment. And so we need to get back to a more stable lending environment, a little bit lower interest rates. And I think that will take a lot of the burden off of creating new housing away. So that's my first hope for 24. As it relates to the city and the state, I am hopeful that a package, as we talked about earlier, a 421A, labor, and some version of good cause could come together by the end of the legislative session. And that, which would probably be towards the end of the year. And so that maybe combined with, you know, change in interest rates really set the stage for new housing starts end 24, early 25 again. So I am hopeful there. You know, on the migrant crisis, I do think that is one of the biggest problems we have in New York today. And it's going to go way beyond just what do we do with all these people, because the problem is you're letting people come in to the United States. They desire to come to New York City because we have been so friendly in terms of taking care of the people that come here. So we wind up with a housing shortage, a food shortage. But then it will ultimately, we also don't let them work. And right. so which to me is one of the crazier dynamics that are happening, because if you let the migrants into this country, and we need immigrants here, this country was built on immigrants, right? And we are short jobs. We are short workers here in the United States and in New York City. In fact, this is the first time I can recall the unions actually supporting immigration and visas for the migrants, because they too recognize that we need more workers, whether it's in our hotels, in our restaurants, on our construction jobs. So I am hopeful the first change we can make is to provide more work visas for the migrants. But I do think we are going to need to lean on our elected officials at the federal level to get federal assistance for housing, for food, for the migrants, because New York City and New York State cannot afford to take care of the migrants that are coming in. And it's not just a New York issue. You know, they said, well, we don't want to give money to New York because that would set precedent. But yes, it is setting precedent. If we're going to let people cross the border, then it's not fair to any city to be overly burdened by that. I don't think it's fair to the Texas cities either, just because that's where they're crossing into.
That's right.
So wherever these migrants wind up, I believe that's a federal government responsibility to pay and care for those migrants and provide them with visas so that they can work. And so, you know, that's really what I think needs to be done at the city and state level. But I think 24 will be a transition year back to a little bit more normalcy, with 25 hopefully being the year for new construction starts and back to a semi-normal environment.
Well, that's great. And I hope your optimism about interest rates coming and stabilizing and getting a deal on 421A and good cause and with labor are going to come true. Those are good New Year's resolutions.
The late, great Sam Zell in the financial crisis of the early 90s would always say, stay alive until 95.
That's right.
And so now we say, stay alive until 25.
You know, you're the second person this week that has used that line on me. So I think that's going around the industry. That's great.
Yep.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Thanks for taking the time. We really appreciate you spending some time with us and sharing your thoughts. And we really hope these conversations will lead to a greater understanding of the housing problem and its potential solutions. We hope everybody's enjoying listening to The Housing Problem. I'm Rafael Sestero.
And I'm Kirk Goodrich. And you can contact us and find out more about affordable housing in New York City and nationally at thehousingproblem.com.
And please subscribe to and share The Housing Problem, because the more we explore the housing problem, the better chance we have of finding the housing solution.
Produced by Paul Jamali. Executive producers Rafael Sestero, Kirk Goodrich, Eric Biederman, and Tom Corsillo. The Housing Problem podcast is a top content production for Merino PR.